Okay, good. So, yeah, I think last time we covered that paragraph on page 362 and 363, the one that goes, oh, actually, in the philosophy of the Sankhyas, we covered before that the conscious being Purusha is the self as originator. And in the philosophy of the Sankhyas, we find developed most thoroughly the metaphysical idea of Purusha Prakriti. So to back up, I think just two major points I'd like to reiterate from what we've studied so far. In this part of the chapter, Sri Aurobindo is bringing back to our attention the main theme of this chapter, which is the relationship between the two major aspects of consciousness that we find ourselves, as mediators or as experiencers in this cosmos. And those two are configured differently depending on the kind of position we take in terms of the scale of consciousness, as he points out. And those different relations are discussed in different philosophies in India. And Sri Aurobindo, as we talked about last time, is here drawing on three different philosophies. And in the very title of the chapter, the duality consisting of Purusha and Prakriti belongs to a philosophy called Sankhya. We are not really sure how old that philosophy is, but it could be as old as the Vedanta, which goes back to about 1,000 years before Christ. Or it could be a little later. We are not really sure. And the other system that he's drawing on is Vedanta, which is the body called the Upanishads. Shyam, can you hear me? Am I being heard?
We can hear you.
Okay. Okay, good. So the second layer is Vedanta, which is talking about Brahman and Maya. Those are the terms in which it configures the duality. And the third layer or philosophy are the theistic philosophies of India, which are based in a body of texts called the Agamas. The Agamas are a compound of the Puranas and the Tantras. And we can discuss what these are, each of them separately, if anybody is interested in that. But the Sankhya is what he's taking up first. The Sankhya talks about Purusha and Prakriti. But before that, Sri Aurobindo stages this part of the discussion by talking about three properties of Brahman. And by these three properties, Brahman manifests itself.
That's the... Hey, I'm dying. Give me that 20 years.
People were to keep their mics shut, that would make for a little easier experience. If you're talking at that point, please unmute your mics, but otherwise mute your mics. So he's staging this part of the discussion by talking about three properties of Brahman, or the one being there is, conscious being, or the monistic being, the one. And those three properties are firstly infinite variation, and that comes into the foreground, because what we are calling the one is something which we can never really properly understand as the one, because we exist in a domain where the word one refers to an instance or to one of many. but we are actually referring to the only one there is. And so this singularity with a capital S is not just one, but also infinite. And so since it is infinite, it is radically infinite, therefore the first property that it has is the property of infinite variation. It can vary itself infinitely. And such a property belongs to the domain of continuity. The one can take infinite values. It can grade itself in a kind of a scale, which is an infinite gradation. Well, the second property he's talking about is the fact that Brahman or the one can position itself in any point of this gradation and, as it were, make that into a point of self-prospection. It can observe the entire infinity of its own being from that point. And it can do so from the infinite number of points available to it. So this property of self-prospection introduces a new kind of experience to Brahman. Brahman's experience of continuity now develops the possibility of discreteness. Because if Brahman can actually make any point within this infinite variation into a point of self-prospection, it can observe or interact with the rest of itself from that point. It has actually discretized itself at that point. It has made that point into a handle for itself. Okay. Now, the third property is the property of exclusion. The property of exclusion introduces another experience to Brahman, which is the experience of individuality separate from other individualities. The experience of continuity in an infinite variation is still the one experiencing itself as infinite potential. The experience of self-prospection introduces the many, but not without losing their oneness. It's the many, each of which knows itself to be the one. The experience of exclusivity or exclusion, what he calls exclusive self-concentration, creates the new experience of independent existence. In other words, each of these discrete points can separate itself from others. Now, our experience, the kind of cosmos in which we find ourselves, is a cosmos of entities, a cosmos of discrete entities and discrete experiences. We experience births and deaths in time. We experience individuals and things in space. So these are discrete experiences that are also exclusive experiences. Each of these entities and each of these experiences are separated from other entities that don't know their oneness. So the oneness is pulled, or actually rather than pulled out, more properly put behind. It's put so far behind that we seem to have lost it. As a matter of fact, every entity, even in its exclusive separateness, is the one that has become the many and the one that has not become the many. In other words, the one that remains an infinite potential and ultimately the only one there is. But these experiences are put behind it so that it seems to have lost these experiences. Now, starting from this kind of standpoint, the third standpoint, we seem to have this experience of exclusive separateness of consciousness, many separate consciousnesses in a single cosmos, in a single world, interacting with each other and with that world. And so that kind of experience has been described by the school of Sankhya as a pragmatic or empirical experience between a conscious being and its unconscious world. I mean, if we talk about the world of matter, material things, it seems to be unconscious. But Sankhya goes further and says that what we think as conscious, in other words, our emotions, our feelings, sensations, our thoughts, are all in fact forms of unconsciousness. They all belong to that large domain called Prakriti, while the only thing that is conscious in us is the Purusha. So Sri Aurobindo has introduced that in that last paragraph that we did last time, and he's saying that Purusha and Prakriti are constantly tied to one another. If one of them is sundered, the other one also disappears. They have a codependent relationship. If Purusha is intermixed with Prakriti, and if it is to identify itself as separate from Prakriti, if it can identify itself completely as separate from Prakriti, all the properties of Prakriti disappear, and it becomes a still center of experience, of conscious experience. And there is nothing to experience. In other words, it's just a conscious being which is static. Now, Sankhya also talks about many Purushas and one Prakriti. In other words, we find many centers of conscious existence separated from each other that coexist in a single world. That world has got properties that are common, material properties, vital properties, and mental properties. But Purushas are many. These are each one a certain point of prospection and separation. And that is how each one can separate itself from the cosmos. The cosmos disappears for it, and it becomes free of the cosmos. But it loses the world at the same time. If, on the other hand, it were to remain in relation with Prakriti, it would be subject to Prakriti. So this becomes the way in which he talks about this duality of Purusha and Prakriti. And this duality has been interpreted in a number of ways by different people, so that, you know, particularly in the light of Vedanta and in the light of the fact, and I think last time we had a long discussion about the normal human, particularly mental need for unity, we find it difficult to posit a radically dualistic cosmos. So Vedantic thought is a monistic thought, and later schools have tried to interpret Sankhya in a variety of ways. And some schools are saying that, and actually it is already there in the early texts of Sankhya, that this codependent relationship actually is premised on a hidden unity. Because indeed, Prakriti's actions are for the freedom and enjoyment of Purusha. In other words, whatever Prakriti is doing is actually premised on a consent, an implied consent of Purusha. If Purusha was to recognize the fact that it has given its implied consent, it could also withhold its consent. If it were to withhold its consent, it would know in its independence, but it could also voluntarily take up the position of the implied consent implied in subjection to Prakriti. Still, it is its own free will, as it were. So that's its freedom. If it knew that to be its true freedom, then it could enjoy. Once you know you're free of something, then you accept it as a form of enjoyment, no longer a form of bondage. So that becomes another way of understanding Sankhya. Sankhya becomes a way by which we understand or we experience the freedom of Purusha and then return to the experience of Prakriti so that the Prakriti becomes experienced now as a form of enjoyment, not of bondage anymore, because one is free in it. And ultimately, the root of freedom introduces enjoyment, whatever it experiences. So that kind of position is what leads us to know ourselves no longer as bound, but as Lord, Isha. So this is a transition from Sankhya to Vedanta, as it were, because there is a certain way by which Sankhya can transition to Vedanta, and the Agamas serve as that transition point, because the Agamas are talking about Ishvara, the Supreme Lord, Lordship over the cosmic Prakriti, things of that kind, and they're saying that this duality need not be a duality that is hard and fast, or the duality that if it is sundered, then there is no experience. But the duality is one that can be reconfigured at a higher scale in terms of Ishvara and Shakti. And at that point, you realize that what you were feeling to be unconscious is actually consciousness itself, and it is the consciousness of the Lord, consciousness of the Spirit. Now, these ideas of Ishvara and Shakti are very old. One doesn't know exactly when they began, but for the first time, they become very powerfully presented in the Bhagavad Gita. The Bhagavad Gita as a text improves in some sense over the Sankhya and also over Vedanta by proposing this kind of relationship between those same dualities at a higher scale of experience. And at that scale, Purusha is no longer an inert witness and giver of consent, but a Lord whose will is in fact manifest through nature as its conscious force, that is Shakti. So here Sri Aurobindo is basically saying that we can accept the truth of Purusha and Prakriti as a pragmatic truth of our everyday experience, but its pragmatism is something that does not hold beyond a certain scale of consciousness. As we rise in the scale of consciousness, we experience that this relation is a different relation. So I think that's where we are right now. Anybody wishes to ask any questions or make any comments, they can do so. Otherwise, we can continue with the next paragraph. I wanted to also say that Sri Aurobindo points out two defects within the Sankhya system that are corrected in the Gita. He doesn't explicitly say that the Gita does the correcting here, but he does it elsewhere. One is what we said about the many Purushas theory. And last time I talked a little bit about Husserlian thought, you know, which is phenomenology, the notion of the transcendental ego. The idea of the transcendental ego is very similar to this notion of the many Purushas. The transcendental ego is an ego that has transcended the givenness of nature and can witness it, but nevertheless knows itself to be separate. And it's a good term, transcendental ego, because this is exactly how the Gita is challenging and modifying that particular idea. The Gita is saying the notion of many Purushas arises because one of the properties of Prakriti itself is not being given its full due. And that property is the ego, ahankara. It is due to the subjection to the last evolute of prakriti, ahankara, that Purusha experiences itself to be many. If it were to recognize the fact that this transcendental ego is also just a form of prakriti, then it would be released and know that there is only one Purusha, just as that there is only one prakriti. At that point, one has transitioned from the individual and has come into union with the cosmic Purusha, just as one then recognizes the individual nature to be nothing but a formulation of the cosmic prakriti. There is one Purusha and one prakriti. The other defect is the defect of thinking of nature as unconscious. Prakriti seems to be unconscious, but as a matter of fact, that unconsciousness is only a self-limitation and a self-exclusion of the one consciousness there is. In other words, Maya or Shakti has become Prakriti by hiding or limiting its own intelligence and its own unity with Brahman and its connection with Ishvara. So if we are to rise in the scale of prakriti, of nature, we'll arrive at a point where we see that prakriti is not only one, but prakriti is also conscious. Prakriti is consciousness itself. It is the energy force of consciousness of the Lord, the Ishvara, looked at from the Agamic point of view, and it is the consciousness aspect of Brahman looked at from the Vedantic point of view.
Jambashish, could I ask a question about the transcendental ego?
Yes.
I'm sorry, it may have been taken up last time and I missed it, but I'm not sure from what's been said so far if that is something that's pre-existing or it's something that is developed through prakriti.
Yeah, the idea of the transcendental ego is a modern idea in Western philosophy. It arises, it's the term used by Edmund Husserl, who is talking about our experience in the world. So it's an interesting branch of philosophy. It's phenomenology. He's the founder of the branch called phenomenology. And essentially it's called phenomenology because he's saying that we find ourselves thrown into this world of experience without really questioning it. We take it for granted. But were we to question it, in other words, were we to, he uses the term bracket, which means were we to put aside the assumption that what we experience is reality, then we could, in a sense, as conscious beings, find a vantage from which whatever we experience is seen as beyond our experiencing selves. In other words, why is it that reality comes to us as it comes to us? Okay, now, and kind of that stream of thought is further developed by his disciple Heidegger, who's saying essentially that, I'm conflating a little bit both Husserl and Heidegger here, where they're saying that what gives the world to us as it is our intentionality. And intentionality is already formed for us by what is called the life world. The life world is the given world. It is Prakriti, if we want to make the switch into the Indian scale. So this world that we experience is already demanding a certain kind of attention from us. That's its the intentionality with which we are connected with the world. See, so we, for example, use the world in a certain way. The world comes to us as a world of use, and we see or experience the world in that way. If we look at a tree, we see it for whatever properties make the tree real to us, partly as a usable object and partly as an object which is mysterious beyond our use. But the more beyond our use it is, the less of a contact or connection we have with it. So that's our intentionality that connects us to the world in which we find ourselves. Now, were we to question that, we could question that at a certain level and say, why is it that we see certain things? Why is it that certain things have meaning for us? And we realize that world of meanings is given to us. It's partly the world of language into which we are born. It's how the world configures itself for use in a common sense, and we experience it like that. Now, if we were to question that, then we'd be able to arrive at a certain kind of witnessing which transcends that yet makes us feel as if we are separate from it and separate from each other, but still transcending the structures by which the world demands our attention. That particular witnessing consciousness is called the transcendental ego. So the transcendental ego is transcendent of the intentional demands of the world, but at the same time, it is separate from the world and from other interacting beings. And that's why it's an ego. So in a way, that's why I draw the parallel between that kind of experience and the many Purushas' experience of Sankhya, where one experiences oneself as a center of conscious witnessing, but also as a separate center of conscious witnessing, separate from other centers of conscious witnessing. Therefore, one is like essentially one can call oneself a transcendental ego. Does that make sense, Olga?
Yes, it does. Thank you very much. There's obviously a lot more to think about, but it helps a lot.
Okay. Would anybody else like to say anything on that? Justin, would you like to say anything about that, about this discussion? Because I know you have a grounding in phenomenology, and so I was just wondering if there's anything you'd like to add or comment on.
Thank you. I do have a connection between this notion of intention that certainly and the sense of the project in Heidegger.
Yes.
The Entwurf, and yet all of this intention and intentionality, in reading the Yoga Sutra, there's a sense that there's a kind of emergence of an intention in samadhi, where the other intentions are either drawn together or that they're actually let go of. And so I guess in this, and there's such an important manner in which discussion of intention is a kind of manner in which this Eastern-Western train, this locomotive of the union of these two thoughts is actually beginning to take place, to move in this direction. So it's a comment. And it's also a kind of perhaps an opportunity to see, I mean, if you would consider that intention on from the Heideggerian perspective. Of course, it becomes Gelassenheit. You know, all of these projects actually become gelassen, or allowed to be let, to be left off, to leave. And I'm just wondering if there is in this, as we're approaching this text, something that would work with this play of intention, and then I guess the question of whether there's an intentioned consciousness as opposed to an unintentioned just a sense of awareness, sakshi.
Yeah. Very, very important. Very good. Good comment. I think also one has to realize that, say, the Yoga Sutra is actually not what he's referring to over here as the Sankhya that talks about the many Purushas. Yoga Sutra makes no mention of the many Purushas. The Yoga Sutra is already a later text that perhaps in some ways is a hybrid text. The idea of the many Purushas, Sankhya Karika has got that idea in it. It's more classical Sankhya. Sankhya undergoes a lot of changes, and the Gita is a very major sort of player in the transformation of Sankhya, so that we really don't know exactly how Sankhya comes or was before the Gita existed. Now, non-intentional consciousness, samadhi, for example, is non-intentional consciousness, or even non-intentional consciousness is transcendental ego. These are both forms of non-intentional consciousness. But in the transcendental ego, it is non-intentional consciousness, but not non-separate consciousness. It is separated, and at the same time, there is no intention to it. That is a kind of sakshi. That is the what one might call the, you know, necessary and sufficient condition for the existence of a sakshi. But he's saying that going, there is one step beyond in which there is non-intentional, non-separate consciousness, in which one recognizes that Prakriti has one more evolute, which is the Ahankara, ego. And then there is another step into the Ishvara, where one realizes that there is the root of intention, which is a cosmic root, which ties together everything. There is one being who is willing the world, who ultimately is becoming. There is only one becoming, and that is the becoming of being. And to partake of the intention that is the will of the Ishvara, is the resolution of that duality in knowing that it is the Ishvara's own Shakti that has become Prakriti.
Thank you. This will of Ishvara, I don't wish to go too far afield, but there is in Kirit Joshi's discussion of the synthesis of yoga.
Yes.
A portion in which he discusses the five yamas. It's available on the archives, Kirit Joshi,
yes,
archives. And in that lecture, he discusses brahmacharya as the development of willpower to,
yes,
deal with these impulses.
Yes.
And when brahmacharya for him is fully present, that the divine will is, it seems to be what is moving through as the other impurities. I don't know if that's quite correct, but impurities are allowed to diminish or move back as this true sense of willpower develops. Is that approaching this discussion of Ishvara through the notion of brahmacharya?
Yeah, absolutely, Justin. I think that's very interesting. And so there, what he's doing is looking at the yamas and niyamas of the Yoga Sutra. And then he is looking at those as means by which the Prakriti can itself be made an instrument that leads us into the Ishvara. So that's why I think the Yoga Sutra is already quite an advanced and complex text that contains a lot more than classical Sankhya. And I think I'd love to see that passage. And if you can post that on the True Person site, we can all enjoy that discussion that you're talking about of Kiri Josh.
Yes, yes, sir. Absolutely. Thank you.
Sure. John Robert, would you like to read next?
Okay, so we're starting with, it is the reality?
Yes.
It is the reality, the self, that takes the position of the conscious being regarding and accepting or ruling the works of its own nature. An apparent duality is created in order that there may be a free action of nature working itself out with the support of the spirit. And again, a free and masterful action of the spirit, controlling and working out nature. This duality is also necessary that the spirit may be at any time at liberty to draw back from the formation of its nature and dissolve all formation, or accept or enforce a new or a higher formation. These are very evident possibilities of the spirit in its dealings with its own force, and they can be observed and verified in our own experience. They are logical results of the powers of the infinite consciousness, powers which we have seen to be native to its infinity. The Purusha aspect and the Prakriti aspect go always together. And whatever status nature or consciousness force in action assumes, manifests, or develops, there is a corresponding status of the spirit. In its supreme status, the spirit is the supreme conscious being, Purushottama, and the consciousness force is his supreme nature, Paraprakriti. In each status of the gradations of nature, the spirit takes the poise of its being proper to that gradation. In mind nature, it becomes the mental being. In life nature, it becomes the vital being. In nature of matter, it becomes the physical being. In supermind, it becomes the being of knowledge. In the supreme spiritual status, it becomes the being of bliss and pure existence. In us, in the embodied individual, it stands behind all as the psychic entity, the inner self, supporting the other formations of our consciousness and spiritual existence. The Purusha, individual in us, is cosmic in the cosmos, transcendent in the transcendence. The identity with the self is apparent, but it is the self in its pure, impersonal, personal status of a spirit in things and beings, impersonal because undifferentiated by personal quality, personal because it presides over the individuations of self in each individual, which deals with the works of its consciousness force, its executive force of self-nature, in whatever poise is necessary for that purpose.
So here, as you see, he is now looking at this relationship as a relationship related to the scale of consciousness. And the idea of the scale of consciousness, as we saw, is originally the variation of Brahman. Brahman as variation, the one as infinitely variable. Remember, we looked at the first property of Brahman as the infinite one, as having the possibility of continuous self-variation in each of its infinite properties. Now, the property of being as a continuous self-variation can be thought of as a superconscience at one end, actually the more properly the property of consciousness. Being is one. There is only one being throughout, but its consciousness can be a self-modulation, an infinite variation, an infinitely variable self-modulation. So we can think of it as fully conscious, and when we use the term fully, since we are dealing with infinity, we are talking about a scale of infinite self-consciousness that falls into a trance of infinite samadhi. That has been called Turiya, the fourth state, the state beyond name, which is itself a gradation without end in self-consciousness. And going down to a self-modulation of consciousness to a apparent infinite inconscience. Now, along the scale, we can also identify ranges, and if we do identify a range where a certain set of properties becomes manifest, the properties of consciousness become manifest, beyond those ranges, beyond that range, those properties do not hold anymore, then we can say that that being actually exists within that range as a certain type of consciousness. Like he's talking about mental consciousness, vital consciousness, knowledge consciousness, bliss consciousness, material consciousness. Now, if we look at that scale, along the second scale, the scale of discreteness, in other words, these ranges, when we give them a name, call them mental, vital, etc., we're talking about a certain range within which being prospects, in other words, puts itself behind that particular range and becomes the mental being, the vital being, physical being, etc. It's the one being, but because of its second property, it can discretize itself like that. Now, as we can see in the gradation of consciousness, the further we go into inconscience, the more unconscious this being becomes. The relationship between being and consciousness is getting reversed, so that at the inconscient level, we find that being is completely obscured because consciousness is completely latent. But in this state, it is as if the will to manifest has taken a back seat and allowed the property of chaos to do what it wills under latent laws, laws of the world of knowledge, for example, of supermind, or of the latency of life, mind, supermind, and bliss, that take their own play with being as it were, subject to this play. And so it's a reversal. It's Prakriti. That's where Prakriti is doing what it wills as almost a separated entity. And Purusha is subject to the play of Prakriti. And he points out in this paragraph that that is deliberately done, because it is by that power that is the self, the exclusive self-concentration, the third property of Brahman, by which an apparent duality is created, as he says, in order that there may be a free action of nature working itself out with the support of the spirit, and again a free and masterful action of the spirit controlling and working out nature. So this spirit or being in this particular case can withhold sanction and free itself from any one of these actions that nature is taking, or it can allow itself to be driven by whatever nature is exploring. It's the explorations of Prakriti to which it allows itself, or it can hold back these possibilities that nature is developing. Now, that kind of a play is what results in the nature of the relation between being and consciousness that we experience. And that defines the phenomenology of Purusha-Prakriti in our experience. See, this is how he's pointing it out. Now, he's saying at the heights, however, this thing called Purusha is the Purushottama, and this thing called Prakriti is the Paraprakriti. And these terms, as I was pointing out earlier, are drawn from the Gita. This is the Gita's Vedantic modification of Sankhya. Gita is bringing in new terms, and the reason it's introducing these terms is because it is showing this particular relationship between being and consciousness as a scale in consciousness that at its heights reveals itself to be the one that has become two, and at its depths are the two that are contesting one another. See, so it's basically they're separated into two, one given the opportunity to know itself as the other, and at the height, it is only the will of the one that has split itself into two. All along the scale of variation, what we have is gradations of consciousness, and each one of these gradations gives us a different station in the relation between being and consciousness. As he says, physical being with its physical consciousness, vital being with its vital consciousness, mental being with its mental consciousness, the knowledge being or supramental being with its supramental consciousness, bliss being with its bliss consciousness. In this formulation, Sri Aurobindo is following the Taittiriya Upanishad, where it talks about this gradation and leaves out the being of consciousness and the being of being. In other words, chit and sat. And it does that because Sri Aurobindo points out that from supermind to bliss is the highest that is possible to individualized nature. Jiva can experience the play of Purusha and Prakriti up to the ananda consciousness. To go beyond that, without entering into the samadhi of the fourth state, Turiya, one would require to develop a certain kind of stability in the ananda plane, which has not yet happened. We haven't even reached beyond the avidya into the supramental plane. That's our next transition. So to talk about a relationship between Purusha and Prakriti, or relationship between being and consciousness beyond the Ananda plane, is not possible to us at this point.
Well, that's pretty mind-blowing.
Yes.
I find the scale of the scale in consciousness very illuminating, because, and as you say, it takes us into knowledge being and bliss being. So it seems to me that we're really talking about an understood exploration of consciousness, or an exploration of consciousness with awareness, which I think is what we were talking about before. The intentionality and the awareness are much the same thing.
Yeah, absolutely, Olga. It is exploration of the relation between being and consciousness with awareness, absolutely right. And it's really the persistence of the jiva, the persistence of the individual that he's talking about over here. That at the phenomenology of Purusha and Prakriti at the level of the physical being is one in which this experience of being a conscious being in an unconscious world presents itself to us. It seems as if that's the thrownness of Heidegger. You know, we find ourselves thrown into this world, things are happening around us, and we have to make sense of it and swim or drown, basically. At higher levels, and that's actually, if we actually look at the whole creation and the cosmos, we find that at the scale of, material forms, that's absolutely the case. Things are formed temporarily by the forces of nature. They maintain themselves so long as the forces have a certain kind of, temporary equilibrium. As soon as those forces go beyond a certain kind of equilibrium, those forms dissolve. Then you come to rudimentary life forms that already are separated from the rest of the cosmos through some membrane that gives it interiority. And within that interiority, there forms a certain will to survival. That independent form as a jiva, as a creature, can maintain itself and experience the relationship between Purusha and Prakriti at that level. At the level of life, it is experiencing that as the life being and the life consciousness, Purusha and Prakriti of life, Pranamaya Purusha and Pranamaya Prakriti. At the mind level, where we start having creatures with brains, but rudimentary brains and then more developed brains, up to the human being, where buddhi is the property or evolute of Prakriti that is fully manifest, we find another kind of relationship, a relationship which has a much stronger sense of persistence at the individual level. And we have a much stronger ego. We also have a much stronger sense of the permanent, because we have a different relationship with time. We have a knowledge of the past and a knowledge of the future, which way outlasts our individual existence between birth and death. So this is a different property which is being manifest in the relationship between being and consciousness at the mental level. So beyond that, we have that which is supramental. But he's pointing out that the individual, the jiva, it cannot persist as an individual below the range of, let's say, the microorganism and it cannot persist as an individual above the range of, let's say, the mind beyond a certain point. However, the devas, the gods, do exist in over mind. They are devas that exist in supermind. And human beings can actually have an individuality that can persist. That's the whole enterprise of entering into a supramental manifestation where we build the structures whereby we can endure, one may say, the kind of consciousness that belongs to supermind. And he's saying it's possible to go even beyond that into the Ananda plane as we are constituted right now. Very great yogis have done that. It is potentially possible to human beings. But beyond that, it is not yet potentially possible. It awaits the future evolution even beyond the supermind.
So she's taking up your point that the humans can persist in this process to build structures. That would seem to be a unique faculty of humanity.
And, I agree.
And the reason that humanity has evolved to its present state.
Absolutely. It has evolved to its present state almost purely by the yoga of Prakriti. In other words, Prakriti itself, that's why he's saying what is happening here is at the heights, Purusha is master of Prakriti, and Prakriti, you know, that's what we were discussing about the Yab-Yum, the kind of union of the two, where the Purusha and the Prakriti are completely in consonance. They're fully aware of each other as an identity. You know, one is the knowledge, the other is the will. It's the knowledge dash will of the Supreme that is being experienced at all times. But at the evolutionary bottom rung, on the other hand, the equation has changed and Prakriti is master over Purusha. Prakriti is leading the race and Purusha is trying to survive within the activities of Prakriti. And so it is Prakriti's yoga, Prakriti through that action, which seems to be completely chaotic, is nevertheless evolving forms within which Purusha can endure, and endure in both ways. Endure meaning have staying power, and also endure meaning tolerate, be able to bear the intensities of Prakriti at that particular level. So that, you know, that sort of creation of Prakriti that calls down into it a new prospection, self-prospection of Purusha, a new point of being of the individual jiva, is what has been happening so far. But once Prakriti moves through the rungs of physical Prakriti, vital Prakriti, mental Prakriti, and develops its evolute of intelligence, buddhi, something very interesting happens that Sankhya does not address at all. With the arrival of the buddhi, enters into the kind of Prakritic instrument that is now formed by the power of the yoga of Prakriti, a new kind of Purusha, which Sri Aurobindo is calling the psychic being. That's why he ends that particular that particular paragraph by saying that each one of these coexist in the human, but he says in us, in the embodied individual, that same it, meaning that Purusha, that being, stands behind all as the psychic entity the inner self supporting the other formulations of our consciousness and spiritual existence. The Purusha, individual in us, is cosmic in the cosmos, transcendent in the transcendence. Now, this psychic being, once we have the intellect that has appeared in Prakriti, develops a certain kind of power where it can reverse, it's really the fulcrum, it reverses the relationship between Purusha and Prakriti for the first time, whereby from the bottom run, Prakriti took the lead over Purusha, now Purusha can take the lead over Prakriti and form new structures of Prakriti that can house new formations of Purusha. And the next formation of Purusha that is to be housed is the supramental Purusha. And that form, the Prakriti that will house it can only be formed by power of yoga. And once that is done, then that opens up the possibilities of the other rungs, the rungs of Ananda, Chit and Sat. So you're absolutely right. This is a unique position that he's given to the human being. And it parallels the saying of the Bible that the human being is made in the image of God. It is made in the image of God exactly because the psychic being, for the first time in nature, has a physicality, a vitality, and a mentality, which is the rudimentary formation, which makes it possible for it to develop new properties that connect it with God, in other words. So that's what, in a way, he's leading to from Sankhya into Vedanta and into the hidden meanings that exist in the Agamas and in the Vedanta.
Devashish, when you were talking about Purusha and Prakriti a little bit ago, you used the words will and knowledge. And I thought you were using them as synonyms for each of those two Indian philosophical terms. Is that right?
John Robert, I use those terms for the relationship between Purusha and Prakriti at the heights of particularly beyond the mind, where I said the two are united, one as will and the other as knowledge. Actually, both are the being, but one has become pure will and the other exists as the knowledge of that will. But the two are still united. That's why Sri Aurobindo, when he talks about supramental being, uses the term knowledge-will. Knowledge-will. Knowledge-will is the two-in-one. And that is another way of talking about the two that we are talking about, but only at the heights of the supermind. Now, below, we can talk about knowledge and will as having become the conscious being, and the force of nature. The will has become the force of nature. It is that which is seemingly chaotic, but it is intention. And those intentions are coming up from, you know, the tonic forces of nature through the vital existence into the life world with its mental meanings and its world of language and utility into which we find ourselves thrown. And so we as conscious being and the world of will are in relation, as it were, in a struggle, in a kind of sink or swim situation. But behind that sink or swim situation is a greater will, which is the evolutionary will. that is using that to form the inner bodies of the Purusha that will be able to endure and persist within the structures of Prakriti that are being developed.
So then would you say that this fulcrum or this crisis point where Purusha and Prakriti in evolution change places is the kind of the occult explanation of the crisis of the world that we're living in?
Yeah, in a sense, yes, and actually a little more than that, John Robert, because that fulcrum or the relationship between Purusha and Prakriti that becomes possible with the emergence of the psychic being has been around since the appearance of the human, which is many millennia back, you know, I mean, going back to Homo erectus and Homo sapiens. But what we see now, the evolution of Prakriti has not stopped. It isn't as if the evolution of Prakriti stopped with the human once Homo erectus came on the stage. As, say, for example, if you look at the work of Jean Getzer, he's talking about mutations of the structures of consciousness. So, it seems as if we have the same properties, we do the same thing, we have the same intellect, etc. But in a way, we are utilizing powers of intellect in new and different ways. And we are at a certain crisis point right now, because the crisis point right now lies in the fact, as I said, the fact of our relationship with time being such that we seem to have learned enough of the lessons of the mind to know that we've reached a certain kind of saturation point in an occult sense, as you're saying. You know, the sort of early 20th century writer H.G. Wells had a kind of a short history of the world in which the last chapter is called Mind at its Tether, Mind at the Limit of its Stretch. And that's exactly where we are now. In an occult sense, the mind has learned lessons which we look back at, and our entire education from childhood is geared towards giving human beings the sense of the weight of history, where we actually feel that we have learned these lessons, but we can't do anything about it. In a sense, our vital is not adequate to these lessons. We repeat the same mistakes over and over again, which is what makes us so tragic. But at the same time, it isn't like in the past where we didn't know that we are repeating the same mistake. Now we know it and we feel the weight of it. And yet we don't know what to do, which is what creates a new aspiration in us. That new aspiration is the crisis of our time. That is what is opening up the formations of Prakriti that would make possible something greater, a greater being and a greater nature. And that reversal, we were using the term fulcrum also from the viewpoint of the term that the mother has used, the phrase, the reversal of consciousness. The reversal of consciousness is exactly that. The point where Purusha suddenly takes Prakriti in its hands and starts creating the structures by which new formations of Purusha can enter.
I think she said
that the reversal was that the sense of being separate, which is out in front of us and which is our empirical experience, and the sense of unity which is behind would reverse, so that the sense of unity would be our regular experience instead of the reverse.
That could be one of the properties that reversal expresses. But reversal of consciousness, the mother uses, if you look at it, she uses it really in terms of the emergence of the psychic being. The psychic being's emergence and its active role in our life reverses our consciousness, because we are no longer at the mercy of Prakriti, but we become the masters of Prakriti. And we can, from that point on, have a different kind of role in the way in which the yoga proceeds.
Okay, thank you.
Are you using Purusha and psychic being interchangeably? It was my understanding that Purusha is unchangeable and that the psychic being is in the process of evolution.
Now, Purusha is unchangeable is the Sankhya understanding, but this very paragraph that we just read, if you read it once again to yourself, you'll see that he complicates that understanding completely. And he ends by pointing out that the psychic entity is the Purusha behind all the other Purushas. So there is ultimately a scale of Purushas. There is no one Purusha. There is a one Purusha, but that one Purusha has also become these many Purushas that are related to the many Prakritis depending on the scale of consciousness at which it is active. And behind all these various Purusha-Prakriti relations in the human is the psychic being. That is the Purusha, which what he calls needs to become the central being. Right now it is not the central being, but that is the Purusha that ultimately is closest to the Supreme Purusha in us. So that's why if you look at that paragraph, he talks about the scale of consciousness and the different relations between the beings, the physical being, the vital being, the mental being, the being of knowledge. Each one of these is a Purusha. You have the Purusha. The word being can be used interchangeably with Purusha. The word nature can be used interchangeably with Prakriti. And then he says, in us, in the embodied individual, it stands behind all. It there is the Purusha as the psychic entity, the inner self supporting the other formulations of our consciousness and spiritual existence. The Purusha, individual in us, is cosmic in the cosmos, transcendent in the transcendence. That is the Purusha. The Purusha as static is only a relatively unformed understanding which belongs to the realm of Sankhya. It's not the truth of things that belongs to the scale or gradation of consciousness.
Thank you.
Devashish, so experientially, the difference between looking out at the world via the mental Purusha or via the psychic being, they feel different, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, absolutely. So each one of these beings, when we talk about, actually it also relates to the question I think that Matteo asked, each one of these Purushas in the scale of consciousness, if we talk about, so when we are talking about Purusha and Prakriti, remember we talked about, first he introduced those three properties of Brahman, and the second property, which is the property of self-prospection. In other words, Brahman can enter into relationship with a certain range of consciousness, with what we call the range of physical consciousness, the range of vital consciousness, the range of mental consciousness. And when it enters into relationship with that range, it is static and it becomes that kind of Purusha. It becomes the mental Purusha. The mental Purusha is static, but who is becoming that particular thing? It is Brahman that is becoming that. So Brahman is beyond each of these specific formulations. We usually don't experience the vital Purusha. We usually don't experience the physical Purusha. The mental Purusha is more easy to experience in meditation, for example. In fact, meditation, the goal of meditation, if one was to ask that question, is the experience of the mental Purusha. So too, one may say that the goal of, you know, the older yogas that use prana, the pranayama, for example, the goal of a pranayamic yoga would be to experience the vital Purusha. The goal of Hatha Yoga is to experience the physical Purusha. Each one of these is a static Purusha, but they are self-becomings of the dynamic Purusha. That Purusha is behind all these as the psychic being. So the psychic being is evolutionary, and it also experiences its own existence as a dynamic evolution which is bringing new powers of Purusha-Prakriti relation into the cosmos and into the individual. So that is the way in which psychic being is experienced differently from any one of these beings. And it is experienced both as of the nature of the Supreme and as in relation with the Supreme.
That's just wonderful, Devashish. Thank you. And also, you're talking about developing the new structures that the supramental Purusha can enter into. That's what Mother found out in July, whenever it was, 70, when she saw that it would be the psychic being that would create the supramental body.
Absolutely.
So that's what that's all about.
That is it. The mother says, somebody asks the mother, you know, the triple transformation. What is the triple transformation? To whom does the triple transformation belong? And she says, to the psychic being, of course. You know, I mean, it's plain as anything else for her. It is the triple transformation of the psychic being. Who will become supramental? The psychic being will become supramental. It is the psychic being's yoga. The reversal of consciousness makes the beginning of that possible. The psychic being is the one that then starts transforming the nature and changing its own status from the individual psychic being to the cosmic Purusha individualized and then to the supramental Purusha individualized. That is the triple transformation, or at least one part of it. The other part of it is the full transformation of the other three prakritis through the power of the transformed supramental, of the transformed psychic being. Actually, not so much the transformed psychic being as the change in status of the psychic being.
So you're saying that that the psychic being becomes spiritualized and then supramentalized?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness me. Thank you.
Devashishtha, the experiences that we read in Isha Upanishad and Keno Upanishad, the experience of seeing the Brahman in everything at every moment, and Keno Upanishad, let's say that there is this power that has created the mind and mind is not being able to apprehend this power. So those experiences are not, they are all beyond the mental Purusha, right? They are all experiences of the psychic being.
No, they are not experiences of the psychic being, they are experiences of the Brahman.
now, but who is the experiencer?
The experiencer actually could be any one of the beings. In fact, you know, like for example, when you have in the Kena Upanishad, that the Kena Upanishad that you're talking about, where Brahman comes to the three entities there. First it comes to Vayu, then it comes to Agni, then it comes to Indra. Each one of these is one of the beings in us, like say the Purusha of the physical, the Purusha of the vital, the Purusha of the mental. Indra is the Purusha of the mental. And Sri Aurobindo points out that of the three, it is only Indra that can pursue Brahman to the point where the Divine Mother points beyond and says, he has vanished there. That vanished there, that idea is that there is a higher station of the Purusha and Brahman has gone there. Brahman belongs there. But Brahman belongs even beyond that. Brahman has disappeared there. Not that is Brahman, but Brahman has disappeared there. It's like telling Indra, your station can't go beyond where you are. Now, that particular Upanishad is saying nothing about the psychic being. It's not giving us access to Brahman. That access can come only by the power of the psychic being forming these structures that we are talking about. The Upanishad does not give us the yoga of those structures. It's only the Veda that gives us those structures in a recondite way. And Sri Aurobindo is drawing on that. And he's saying essentially that the psychic being must create those structures. Experience of Brahman beyond the mind, beyond the realm of Indra, is something that the Upanishads are pointing to as a kind of samadhi. That's why they're saying that going beyond the world of Swapna, you enter into Sushupti, and even beyond that, you enter into Turiya. But it is not telling you how to unite Jagrat, Swapna, Sushupti, and Turiya, how the four can coexist and become Jagrat. The psychic being is needed for that. It doesn't tell you about it.
Yeah, but at least it tells you that you cannot get there with your mental purusha. You have to go to the next status.
Yeah, that it does.
Thank you.
Should we attempt to read the next paragraph, or shall we save that for next week, given that we have barely 5 minutes to 9 o'clock?
Maybe we can read it. We can read the next paragraph and then keep that in mind for the next time.
Sure. Dan Wood, would you like to read?
Sure. But it is evident that whatever the posture taken or relation formed in any individual notice of Purusha Prakriti, the being is in a fundamental cosmic relation, lord or ruler of its nature. For even when it allows nature to have its own way with it, its consent is necessary to support her workings. This comes out in its fullest revelation, in the third aspect of the reality, the divine being who is the master and creator of the universe. Here, the supreme person, the being in its transcendental and cosmic consciousness and force, comes to the front, omnipotent, omniscient, the controller of all energies, the conscious in all that is conscient or inconscient, the inhabitant of all souls and minds and hearts and bodies, the ruler or overruler of all works, the enjoyer of all delight, the creator who has built all things in his own being, the all person of whom all beings are personalities, the power from whom all are all powers, the self, the spirit in all, by his being the father of all that is, in his consciousness force, the divine mother, the friend of all creatures, the all blissful and all beautiful, of whom beauty and joy are the revelation, the all beloved and all lover. In a certain sense, so seen and understood, this becomes the most comprehensive of the aspects of the reality, since here all are united in a single formulation. For the Ishvara is a supracosmic as well as intracosmic. He is that which exceeds and inhabits and supports all individuality. He is the supreme and universal Brahman, the absolute, the supreme self, the supreme Purusha. But, very clearly, this is not the personal God of popular religions, a being limited by his qualities, individual and separate from all others. For all such personal gods are only limited representations or names and divine personalities of the one Ishvara. Neither is this the Saguna Brahman, active and possessed of qualities, for that is only one side of the being of the Ishvara. The Nirguna, immobile and without qualities, is another aspect of his existence. Ishvara is Brahman, the reality, self, spirit, revealed as possessor, enjoyer of his own self-existence, creator of the universe and one with it, pantheos, and yet superior to it, the eternal, the infinite, the ineffable, the divine transcendence.
Okay, so I think we can stop there and proceed from that point in our next.
Sure. So we'll stop now and continue two Saturdays from now, Devashilva.
Thank you, Devashish.
Yeah, thank you, Devashilva. So we'll stop here and continue two Saturdays from now.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Is the next Devashish.
Devashish is the next.